A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. The first half of Chapter 4, The State of Degradation to Which Woman is Reduced by Various Causes. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. It is clear, I think, that woman is naturally weak or degraded by a combination of circumstances. I shall lay this alongside a conclusion that I have often heard sensible men assert in favour of an aristocracy, namely, most people are a sort of nothing. If they weren't, the obsequious slaves who patiently allow themselves to be imprisoned would have a sense of their own worth and would throw off their chains. Men everywhere submit to oppression, when they have only to lift up their heads to throw off the yoke. Yet, instead of asserting their birthright, they quietly lick the dust and say, "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Women, I argue from analogy, are degraded by the same inclination, to enjoy the present moment and eventually to despise the freedom that they haven't enough virtue to struggle to attain. But I must be more explicit. As regards people's ability to manage and develop their feelings, no one thinks that males are ahead of females, or vice versa. But we do have to reckon with the view that males are ahead of females when it comes to intellectual powers. The only positive feature that woman is credited with having absolutely is loveliness. As for rationality, the fraction of that that's conceded to her is a tiny one. For when she has been denied high-level intellect and judgment, what is there left to count as her intellect? Women are credited with having more goodness of heart, piety, and benevolence than men. This is meant as a compliment, but I doubt that it is true, unless ignorance is the mother of invention. I am quite convinced that people's virtue is, on average, roughly proportional to their knowledge, nearer to being proportional to it than it is usually thought to be. What immortality is for is the perfectibility of human reason. If man were created perfect, or if when he reached maturity a flood of knowledge broke in on him and preserved him from error, I am not sure that his existence would continue after the death of his body. But as things are, every difficulty in morals that eludes human solution, that baffles the investigation of profound thinking and the lightning glance of genius, is part of my case for believing in the immortality of the soul. Thus, reason is the simple power of improvement, or, more accurately, of recognizing truth. The nature of reason must be the same in everyone. If reason is an emanation of divinity, the tie that connects the creature with the Creator, can a soul be stamped with the heavenly image if it isn't perfected by the exercise of its own reason? Yet the soul of woman is not allowed to have this distinction, with man always placed between her and reason. She is always represented as being created only to see through a fog, and to believe what she is told. But if woman has reason, which for a moment I will take for granted, she wasn't created merely to be the solace of man, and her sexual character should not destroy her human character. Men have probably been led into this error by viewing education in a false light, seeing it not as the first step in forming a being who will advance gradually towards something like perfection, but only as a preparation for life. That is the basis on which the false system of female manners has been built, robbing the whole sex of its dignity and classing women with the smiling flowers that merely adorn the land. This has always been the language of men, and even highly intelligent women adopt the same sentiments for fear of departing from the character they are supposed to have, just because they are women. Thus, understanding, strictly so called, has been denied to woman, and instinct, refined into wit and cunning for the purposes of life, has been put in its place. The power of generalizing ideas, of drawing comprehensive conclusions from individual observations, is the only thing an immortal being can have that really deserves to be called knowledge. Merely to observe, without trying to explain anything, may serve, very incompletely, as everyday common sense, but where is the reserve laid up that is to cover the soul when it leaves the body? Women have been said not to have this power of generalizing, and some writers have insisted that it is nearly always inconsistent with their sexual character. Let men prove this, and I'll admit that woman only exists for man. In fact, the power of generalizing ideas to any great extent is not very common among men or women. But this activity is the true cultivation of the understanding, and everything works together to make the cultivation of the understanding harder in the female than in the male world. This remark naturally leads into the main subject of the present chapter. I shall now try to point out some of the causes that degrade the female sex and prevent women from generalizing their observations. I shan't go back to ancient times to trace the history of woman. All I need to say is that she has always been either a slave or a despot, and that both these roles hold back the progress of reason. It has always seemed to me that the great source of female folly and vice is narrowness of mind, and the very constitution of civil governments has put almost insuperable obstacles in the way of developing the female understanding, and thus curing the narrowness of the female mind. Yet virtue can be built on no other foundation. The same obstacles are thrown in the way of the rich, with the same results. The proverb has it that necessity is the mother of invention. It is also the mother of virtue. Virtue is an acquisition to which pleasure must be sacrificed, and no one sacrifices pleasure within reach unless his or her mind has been opened and strengthened by adversity, or the pursuit of knowledge goaded on by necessity. It is a good thing for people to have the cares of life to struggle with, for these struggles prevent them from becoming prey to enervating vices purely through idleness. If men and women are born into a tropical zone, where the midday sun of pleasure shines directly down on them, how can they adequately brace their minds to discharge the duties of life, or even to enjoy the affections that carry them out of themselves? Pleasure is the business of a woman's life, according to society's present estimate, and for as long as that continues to be so, not much can be expected from such weak beings. Inheriting the sovereignty of beauty in a lineal descent from Eve, the first fair defect in nature, they have maintained their power by resigning the natural rights that the exercise of reason might have given them, and chosen to be short-lived queens, rather than labour to have the sober pleasures that arise from equality. Exalted by their inferiority, this sounds like a contradiction, they constantly demand homage as women, though experience should teach them that the men who pride themselves on how carefully they pay this insolent respect to the sex are the ones who are most inclined to tyrannize over and despise the very weakness they cherish. Why do women, I write with affectionate solicitude, lower themselves to receive attention and respect from strangers? I mean, attention and respect that go beyond the two-way civility that the dictates of humanity and the politeness of civilization authorize between man and man. Confined in cages like birds, they have nothing to do but to plume themselves and stalk with mock majesty from perch to perch. They are provided with food and clothing and don't have to work to get them, but they give up health, liberty, and virtue in exchange. It isn't surprising, though, that women do this. Who among mankind has ever had enough strength of mind to give up these extraneous prerogatives, rising with the calm dignity of reason to a level above that of common opinion, and daring to be proud of the privileges inherent in man? And there's no point in waiting for this to change, not while hereditary power chokes the affections and nips reason in the bud. In this way, men's passions have placed women on thrones, and until mankind become more reasonable, women will avail themselves of the power that they get with the least exertion, and that is the most indisputable. They will smile, yes, they will smile, even if they are told that in beauty's empire is no mean, and woman, either slave or queen, is quickly scorned when not adored. But the adoration comes first, and the scorn is not anticipated. Louis the 14th, in particular, spread artificial manners and used their glitter to catch the whole nation in his web. Establishing a carefully contrived chain of despotism, he made it worth while for each French person to respect his position and support his power, and women, whom he flattered by a childish attention to the whole sex, obtained during his reign the prince-like distinction that is so fatal to reason and virtue. A king is always a king, and a woman always a woman. His authority and her sex always stand between them and rational discourse. She should be like this with a lover, I agree, and in that relationship her sensibility will naturally lead her to try to arouse emotion to gratify not her vanity, but her heart. I don't count this as coquetry. It is the uncalculated impulse of nature. I exclaim against the sexual desire for conquest only when the heart doesn't come into it. This desire isn't confined to women.
"I have endeavoured," says Lord Chesterfield, "to gain the hearts of 20 women whose persons I would not have given a fig for."
The libertine who, in a gust of passion, takes advantage of some woman's unsuspecting tenderness, is a saint, and compared with this cold-hearted rascal. Yet only taught to please, women are always on the watch to please, and with too heroic ardour they try to gain hearts that they will give up or kick aside, once it is clear that they have won the victory. Now, I must get into the details of the subject. I lament the fact that women are systematically degraded by receiving the trivial attentions that men think it manly to pay to the female sex, when in fact they are insultingly supporting their own superiority. There is nothing graceful about bowing to an inferior. Indeed, these ceremonies strike me as so ludicrous that I could hardly control my muscles when I see a man jump up with eager and serious solicitude to lift a handkerchief or shut a door, when the lady could have done it herself if she moved a pace or two. A wild wish has just flown from my heart to my head, and I won't stifle it, though it may arouse a horse laugh. Except in cases where love animates the behaviour, I do earnestly wish to see the distinction of sex confounded in society. That is, I wish things could be managed in such a way that it was usually not clear whether a given person was male or female. For this sorting into two sexes is, I am firmly persuaded, the basis for the weakness of character ascribed to woman, is the cause why the understanding is neglected, while accomplishments are acquired with care, and why women prefer the graceful virtues to the heroic ones. Every human being wishes to be loved and respected for something, and the common herd will always take the shortest road to the fulfilment of their wishes. The respect paid to wealth and beauty is the surest and least ambiguous road, and as a matter of course it will always attract the eye of common minds. For men to rise from the middle rank of life into prominence, they absolutely must have abilities and virtues, and this explains the well-known fact that the middle rank contains most virtue and abilities. In one social rank at least, men have therefore an opportunity to exert themselves with dignity, and to rise by efforts of kinds that really do improve a rational creature. But the whole female sex are, until their character is formed, in the same condition as the rich, for they are born with certain sexual privileges, and while those are freely available to them, few will ever think of works of supererogation as a means to winning the esteem of a small number of superior people. When do we hear of women who begin in obscurity and boldly claim respect on account of their great abilities or daring virtues? Where are they to be found? To be observed, to be attended to be taken notice of with sympathy, satisfaction, and approval, are all the advantages that they seek.
True, my male readers will probably exclaim, but before they draw any conclusion they should remember that this was written originally to describe not women but the rich.
in Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments, I have found a general characterization of people of rank and fortune that I think very thoroughly applies to the female sex. Let me quote a passage from that book, to add strength to my argument that there is no such thing as female nature or male nature as distinct from human nature. Apart from warriors, no great men of any sort have ever appeared among the nobility. From this fact, we can reasonably infer that their local situation swallowed up the man and produced a character similar to that of women, who are localized, so to speak, by the rank they are placed in as a matter of courtesy. Women, commonly called ladies, are not to be contradicted in company, are not allowed to exert any manual strength. When any virtues are expected from them, they are negative ones: patience, docility, good humour, and flexibility, virtues incompatible with any vigorous exercise of intellect. Besides, by living more with each other and seldom being absolutely alone, they are more under the influence of sentiments than of passions. Solitude and reflection are necessary to give wishes the force of passions, enabling the imagination to enlarge the object and make it the most desirable. The same holds for the rich. They don't deal in general ideas, collected by level-headed thinking or calm investigation, don't deal with them enough to acquire the strength of character on which great resolves are built. But now hear what an acute observer, Adam Smith, says about the great. "Do the great seem unaware of how easily they can get the admiration of the public? Or do they seem to think that, for them as for anyone else, their rank must have been purchased, either by sweat or by blood? If the young nobleman is instructed in how to support the dignity of his rank, and to make himself worthy of the superiority over his fellow citizens that he has acquired through the virtue of his ancestors, what accomplishments is he told to acquire for this purpose? Is he to make himself worthy of his rank by knowledge, hard work, patience, self-denial, or any other kind of virtue? Because his least move is noticed. He acquires a habit of care over every detail of ordinary behaviour, and tries to perform all those small duties with the most exact propriety. Being conscious of how much he is observed, and of how much people are disposed to allow him to have whatever he wants, he acts, even in utterly ordinary situations, with the freedom and loftiness that are naturally inspired by the thought of how the populace view him. Everything about his conduct marks an elegant and graceful sense of his own superiority, something that those who are born lower down the social scale can hardly ever achieve. These are the tricks by which he proposes to make mankind more easily submit to his authority, and govern their inclinations according to his wishes, and in this he usually succeeds. During most of his reign, Louis XIV of France was widely regarded as the most perfect model of a great prince. What were the talents and virtues by which he acquired this great reputation?
The scrupulous and inflexible rightness, the danger and difficulty, the tireless energy of everything he did.
His broad knowledge, his exquisite judgment, his heroic valour? It was none of these. What he did have was the status of the most powerful prince in Europe, which gave him the highest rank among kings. And then, says his historian, and Smith gives a long quotation about Louis XIV's grand and imposing personal manner, his fine voice, his handsomeness, and so on. He then concludes, "These trivial accomplishments, supported by his rank and no doubt by some degree of other talents and virtues, though not an outstanding degree, established this prince in the esteem of his own age and later generations' respect for his memory. Compared with this kingly manner, no other virtue appeared to have any merit. Knowledge, industry, valour, and beneficence were abashed, trembling, and lost all dignity before them."
In the middle rank of life, to continue the comparison, men in their youth are prepared for professions, and marriage is not considered as the grand feature in their lives, whereas women have no other scheme to sharpen their faculties. It is not business, extensive plans,
or any of the excursive flights of ambition that engross their attention. To rise in the world, and be free to run from pleasure to pleasure, they must marry advantageously, and their time is sacrificed, and their persons often legally prostituted, to this objective. When a man enters a profession, he has his eye steadily fixed on some future advantage, and the mind gains great strength by having all its efforts directed to one point, and he regards pleasure as mere relaxation, while women seek pleasure as the main purpose of existence. In fact, from the education women receive from society, the love of pleasure may be said to govern them all. But does this prove that there is a sex in souls? It would be just as rational to declare that the courtiers in France, where a destructive system of despotism had formed their character, were not men because liberty, virtue, and humanity were sacrificed to pleasure and vanity, fatal passions that always domineered over the whole race. The same love of pleasure, encouraged by the overall trend of their education, has a trivializing effect on women's conduct in most circumstances. For instance, they are always anxious about secondary things, and on the watch for adventures, instead of being occupied by duties. When a man undertakes a journey, he usually has its end in view. A woman thinks more of the incidental occurrences, the strange things that may possibly occur on the road, the impression that she may make on her fellow travellers, and above all, she is anxiously intent on the care of the finery that she carries with her, which is more than ever a part of herself when, to use an apt French expression, she is going to produce a sensation. Can dignity of mind exist with such trivial cares? In short, women in general, and the rich of both sexes, have acquired all the follies and vices of civilization, and missed its useful fruit. Here, as always in my generalizations about women, I mean to be allowing for a few exceptions. Their senses are inflamed, and their understandings neglected, so they become the prey of their senses, delicately called their sensibility, and are blown around by every momentary gust of feeling. Thus, civilized women are so weakened by false refinement that their moral condition is much lower than it would have been if they had been left in a state nearer to nature. They are always restless and anxious, and their overused sensibility makes them not only uncomfortable in themselves, but also troublesome, to put it mildly, to others. All their thoughts are about things that are likely to arouse emotion. Their conduct is unstable because they feel when they should reason, and their opinions are wavering because of contradictory emotions, quite different from the wavering produced by deliberation or development in one's thinking. By fits and starts, they are eager in many pursuits, but this eagerness is never concentrated into perseverance, and soon exhausts itself. Sometimes it just wears itself out. Sometimes it meets with some other fleeting passion to which reason has never given any specific gravity, so that neutrality ensues. Miserable? Indeed. Must someone be whose cultivation of mind has tended only to inflame his or her passions? Don't confuse inflaming passions with strengthening them. When the passions are pampered in this way, while the judgment is left unformed, what can be expected to ensue? Undoubtedly, a mixture of madness and folly. These remarks don't apply only to the fair sex, but at present I am talking only about them. Novels, music, poetry and gallantry all tend to make women the creatures of sensation, and their character is thus formed during the time they are acquiring accomplishments, the only improvements that their place in society motivates them to acquire. This overstretched sensibility naturally relaxes the other powers of the mind, preventing the intellect from achieving the sovereignty that it needs to attain to make a rational creature useful to others, and content with his or her own role in life. Because as one grows older, the only natural method for calming the passions is through the exercise of reason. Will moralists claim that this is the condition in which half the human race should be encouraged to remain, with listless inactivity and stupid acquiescence? Kind instructors, what were we created for? To remain innocent?
they may say, meaning to remain in a state of childhood. We might as well never have been born, unless our creation was needed for man to be able to acquire the noble privilege of reason, the power of distinguishing good from evil, while we lie in the dust from which we were taken, never to rise again. It would take for ever to trace the variety of meannesses, cares, and sorrows that women are plunged into by the prevailing opinion that they were created to feel rather than to reason, and that the only way they can obtain any power is through their charms and weakness. In Pope's words, fine by defect and amiably weak. And having been made by this amiable weakness entirely dependent on man, not only for protection but also for advice, is it surprising that women, neglecting the duties that only reason points out, and shrinking from trials that would be likely to strengthen their minds, exert themselves only to give their defects a graceful covering that may serve to heighten their charms in the eye of the voluptuary, though it sinks them below the scale of moral excellence? Fragile, in every sense of the word, they are obliged to look up to man for every comfort. In the most trivial dangers, they cling to their support with a parasite's grip, piteously demanding help, and their natural protector extends his arm or raises his voice to guard the lovely trembler. From what? Perhaps the frown of an old cow? Or the jump of a mouse? A rat would be a serious danger. In the name of reason and even of common sense, what can save such beings from contempt, even if they are soft and fair? When these fears are genuine, they may produce some pretty attitudes, but they show a degree of imbecility that degrades a rational creature in a way women are not aware of, for love is a very different thing from esteem. I'm sure that we would hear no more of these infantile airs if girls were allowed to have enough physical exercise and weren't confined in close rooms until their muscles are relaxed and their powers of digestion destroyed. I would go further. If fear in girls, instead of being valued and perhaps created, were treated in the same way as cowardice in boys, we would quickly see women looking more dignified. It's true that they couldn't then be described as the sweet flowers that smile in the walk of man, but they would be more respect-worthy members of society, performing the important duties of life by the light of their own reason. Educate women like men, says Rousseau, and the more they resemble our sex, the less power will they have over us. That is exactly the point I am making. I don't want women to have power over men. I want them to have power over themselves. Similarly, I have heard men argue against instructing the poor. Teach them to read and write, they say, and you take them out of the role in life assigned them by nature. An eloquent Frenchman has answered them. I will borrow from him. They don't realize that if they make man a lower animal, they can expect to see him at any moment transformed into a ferocious beast. Without knowledge, there can be no morality. Ignorance is a frail basis for virtue. Yet ignorance is the condition for which woman was organized, according to the writers, who have most energetically argued in favor of the superiority of man. They mean this to be a superiority in kind, not merely in degree, though to soften the argument, they have tried with chivalrous generosity to prove that the sexes ought not to be compared. Man was made to reason, they say, woman to feel, and together, spirit and flesh, they make the most perfect whole by happily blending reason and sensibility into one character. And what is sensibility? Quickness of sensation? Quickness of perception? Delicacy? That is how Dr. Johnson defines it. And all I get from the definition is an idea of the most exquisitely polished instinct. I don't see a trace of the image of God in either sensation or matter. Refined 70 times 7, they are still material. Intellect dwells not there, and fire won't turn lead into gold. I come around to my old argument. If woman has an immortal soul, she must have, as the employment of her life, an understanding to improve. And when she is incited by present gratification to forget her grand destination, then nature is counteracted, or else woman was born only to procreate and to rot, i.e. to be mortal. Or here is another possibility. All lower animals have a soul, though not a reasonable one, and their use of instinct and sensibility is the step they have to take in this life towards the attainment of reason in the next. If that is how things stand, and if in this respect woman is in the same boat as the lower animals, she and they will be one step behind man through all eternity, and we can't explain why man was enabled to attain reason in his first mode of existence. When I discuss the special duties of women, in the way that I would discuss the special duties of a citizen or a father, you'll see that I don't mean to imply that women in general should be taken out of their families. Bacon says, "He who has wife and children has given hostages to fortune, for they are impediments to great enterprises, good and bad." Certainly, the achievements that have done the most public good have been the work of unmarried or childless men. I say the same of women. But the welfare of society isn't built on extraordinary efforts, and if society were more reasonably organized, there would be still less need for great abilities or heroic virtues. In running a family and educating children, one has a special need for strength, both of body and of mind, and yet the men who in their writings have worked hardest to domesticate women have tried to weaken their bodies and cramp their minds. But even if these writers really persuaded women, by working in an underhand way on their feelings, to stay at home and fulfil the duties of a mother and mistress of a family, this would be a bad way of getting women to do the right thing, because it would be an insult to reason. I appeal to experience by neglecting the understanding. Women are actually more detached from these domestic duties than they could be by the most serious intellectual pursuit, from which I infer that reason is absolutely necessary to enable a woman to perform any duty properly. And I'll say it again, sensibility is not reason. The comparison with the rich still occurs to me. When men neglect the duties of humanity, women will follow their example. A common stream hurries them both along with thoughtless speed. Riches and honours prevent a man from enlarging his understanding, and slacken all his powers by reversing the order of nature, which has always made true pleasure the reward of labour. Pleasure, enervating pleasure, is similarly within women's reach without their earning it. But until hereditary possessions are distributed throughout society, how can we expect men to be proud of virtue? And until they are, women will govern them by the most direct means, neglecting their dull domestic duties so as to catch the pleasure that is on the wing of time. Another argument that has had a great weight with me must, I think, have some force with every considerate benevolent heart. Girls who have been thus weakly educated are often cruelly left by their parents without any provision, and of course are then dependent not only on the reason, but also on the generosity of their brothers. In the best cases, these brothers are good men, and they give us a favour, what their sisters, as children of the same parents, had an equal right to. An easy-going female may fairly comfortably remain for some time in this ambiguous and humiliating situation. But when the brother marries, as he probably will, the sister will move from being considered as the mistress of the family to being viewed as an intruder, an unnecessary burden on the benevolence of the master of the house and his new partner. Who can describe the misery that many unfortunate beings, whose minds and bodies are equally weak, suffer in such situations, unable to work and ashamed to beg? The wife is likely to be a cold-hearted, narrow-minded woman, for the present style of education doesn't tend to enlarge the heart any more than to enlarge the understanding. This wife will be jealous of the little kindness that her husband shows to his relations, and because her sensibility doesn't rise to the level of humanity, she will be displeased at seeing her children's property being lavished on a helpless sister. These are matters of fact that I have seen for myself again and again.
The upshot is obvious. The wife resorts to cunning, to undermine the habitual affection of her husband for his sister, which she is afraid to oppose openly. She uses tears and caresses relentlessly, until the spy is worked out of her home and thrown on the world, unprepared for its difficulties, or, as a great effort of generosity, or from some regard to propriety, sent with a small pension and an uncultivated mind into joyless solitude. These two women, the sister and the wife, may be much on a par with regard to reason and humanity, and it may be that if their situations had been switched, so would their behaviour have been. But if they had been differently educated, the upshot would also have been very different. The wife wouldn't have had the sensibility of which self is the centre, and reason might have taught her not to expect, and not even to be flattered by, her husband's affection, if it led him to violate pre-existing duties, such as his duty to his sister. She would want to love him, not merely because he loved her, but on account of his virtues, and the sister might have been able to struggle for herself instead of eating the bitter bread of dependence. End of first half of chapter 4.